Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, RCVS recognised specialist in small animal surgery orthopaedics, Simon Roach. Thank you, Simon. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello. Well, welcome to everyone who's attending the webinar this afternoon. The purpose of the webinar was to explore some of the new and fairly novel treatments for patellar luxation that are around. But to give a background, we'll also run through the etiology and the anatomy that's relevant to the condition. So, as you're all aware, patellar luxation is a very common problem that's encountered in small animal practice. It affects numerous breeds, and there is a hereditary basis that has been suspected, and it will affect both large and small dogs, and certainly we see large dogs almost as frequently as small dogs. However, I appreciate in first opinion practice that may be a different sector of animals that are seen. So the particular breeds we tend to see very frequently are the Cavalier King Charles Spaniels. We see Staffordshire Bull Terriers, terriers of other descriptions, so Jack Russells we see quite frequently. And amongst the larger dogs we see lots of Labradors, and we see flat-coated retrievers as well, amongst others, so it isn't an exclusive list at all. The signs that I see associated with patellar luxation are typically those of hind limb lameness that varies in severity quite substantially between mild to non-weight bearing lameness. Equally, there's a very variable onset, and so some dogs will have a very sudden onset of clinical signs, whereas others will have a far more insidious onset. Skipping whilst walking is very, very common. And that is often the first thing that clients will notice, but it isn't always there, to be honest. So just because a dog isn't skipping doesn't mean it doesn't have a patellar luxation. In some dogs, the luxation of the patella can be painful, and in other dogs, it's incredibly well tolerated and it can be subclinical. Some dogs will start with a non-painful luxation, and that will progress to becoming more painful later in life. Other dogs may go the other way, and certainly if there's been a traumatic incident that has torn some of the support structures that support the patella, that may be painful in the initial stages and then become less painful. So clearly we can see that there's a very wide range of clinical signs that are associated with this common condition. In the end, the luxation of the patella will often lead to degenerative changes within the joint and particularly cartilage ulceration, as we will see. I most often see dogs with medial patellar luxation, and that's not surprising because it accounts for approximately 90% of dogs that have a luxating patella will luxate medially. Both large and small breed dogs can be affected by medial patellar luxation. Lateral luxations are far more commonly encountered in larger dogs. Now, when we consider patellar luxation, I think it's important that we consider all of the ways in which the patella is stabilized. And the way I like to think of this is to think about primary stabilization and secondary stabilization. The principal primary stabilizer of the patella is the alignment of the quadriceps mechanism. So that is the fundamental thing that needs to be corrected where we have a dog with a luxating patella. Okay. Secondary stabilizers are really the femoral trochlea, and the depth of the groove, okay, is important, and also the retinaculum, which we will have a look at shortly. So the primary stabilizers, this is really fundamental. The primary stabilization is the quadriceps mechanism, and everything else is just secondary stabilization. In order for luxation to occur, we have to have a failure of both primary and secondary stabilization. Okay. Luxation will not occur if the secondary stabilizers are adequate. Okay. But luxation also needs failure of primary stabilization as well. Now, this can occur as a result of a developmental process. So we may have abnormal femoral or tibial growth that results in malalignment of the quadriceps mechanism, or it may have a partially traumatic etiology in that a blow to the knee may tear the retinaculum. And if there is a pre-existing malalignment of the quadriceps mechanism, the patella can then continue to luxate. Other conditions that will commonly result in patella luxation would include rupture of the cranial cruciate ligament. And the reason for that is that the cranial cruciate ligament is responsible for restricting internal tibial rotation. So when the cruciate ruptures, the tibia can rotate medially, and that can result in patella luxation occurring. The consequences of the patella luxating principally are that the quadriceps muscle loses its mechanical advantage, because the ability of the quadriceps to extend the stifle is dramatically reduced when the tendon, the straight patellar tendon, does not occupy the position right at the front of the knee, at the cranial aspect of the knee. So we get reduced extensor function, and that often leads to a degree of extensor weakness. So dogs may collapse on the leg slightly when the patella luxates. And that's quite an important thing to realise, that there is a loss of strength. Where dogs luxate both patellas simultaneously, they can collapse and they can be unable to stand up at times. And this is quite often interpreted as potentially being associated with spinal problems or what have you, and it may not be. So it's always worth, if you have a dog that can't stand up, check whether its patellas are in or out. It's an important differential. Okay. Luxation of the patella can be painful, as we've mentioned, and we can also see fairly extensive cartilage ulceration. I'm going to try and move the pointer here. So the area that the pointer is indicating is ulcerated cartilage. That is exposed bone that's showing through the hyaline cartilage on the trochlear ridge. And that occurs as a result of repetitive luxation of the patella over the trochlear ridge. We often will see osteoarthritis within joints that are affected by patella luxation, and that can lead to an altered range of motion in severe cases. So let's consider the anatomical features that are important with regard to the development of patella luxation. One of the more common deformities that we see relate to the femoral conformation, and we often will see a distal femoral varus deformity. And you can see this on this reconstructed CT, that the shaft of the femur, the proximal diaphysis, is aligned approximately vertically, and yet the distal femur is deviated off towards the medial side. So this is a femoral varus deformity. Okay. Also important, but slightly more difficult to appreciate on radiographs particularly, is the presence of femoral torsion. And this can be an important factor to consider if we're considering straightening the femur. Okay, it's important that we get these dogs with an optimal shaped femur if we're going to intervene surgically. And the third type of problem that we associate with the femur are problems with the trochlear groove. So I will call these collectively trochlear groove dysplasia. Most commonly that would involve an inadequate depth to the groove, but in some cases, and I think we'll see an example later, we can sometimes have a situation where one side of the groove, one trochlear ridge, has not formed adequately at all. Tibial deformity can also be significant when it comes to patellar luxation, and the commonest manifestation of this would be an abnormally positioned tibial tuberosity. So if the tibial tuberosity is placed more medial than is ideal, then that would predispose to a medial luxation, and if the tuberosity is lateral, then a lateral luxation. In a lot of dogs, we will see an apparently normal tibial conformation, but we have to bear in mind that rotation of the tibia may also be present, and that can occur as a result of rupture of the cruciate ligament or as a consequence of patellar luxation, where the very fact that the patella has luxated will subtly alter the direction of pull of the quadriceps, and it tends to internally rotate the tibia. So that can also be important. When we look at the tibia, it's also important to recognize, particularly if we're going to straighten the bone and possibly do a femoral osteotomy, that we have to recognize that the bone below the knee may have grown in an abnormal fashion to compensate for a femoral deformity. And so this really is out with the scope of this talk today, because this is more related to how to do a limb realignment. But sometimes it is necessary not only to do a corrective osteotomy of the femur, but also to follow that with a corrective tibial osteotomy as well. But that is beyond the scope of this talk. So how do we start to assess a dog that we think has patellar luxation? Well, the first thing to do is to palpate the knee. The diagnosis of patellar luxation is generally made by palpation. Radiographs and imaging can be used to back that up, but frequently when you position them for radiography, because you tend to have them in a stifle extended position, the patella may well have drifted back into the trochlea. So it's something that you need to diagnose with your hands. Okay. Once we've identified patellar luxation, it's important to consider the stance of the dog and the posture. And in particular, we need to consider whether the dog has a fairly normal hind limb stance with regard to being either bow-legged, as is seen on the photo of the Labrador on the right, that would be a genu varum, or whether it has the opposite, whether its knees are close together and it has a knock-kneed conformation, which is a genu valgum. So both of these conformations are important to recognize. The bow-legged appearance, as we can see, is by far the most common reason to cause a medial patellar luxation, whereas the opposite, a knock-kneed appearance, would cause a lateral patellar luxation. We can also, when we're examining dogs, get an idea of the alignment of the joint, and so we can particularly assess if the stifle is pointing in one direction. We can assess whether the hock is facing in that same direction, or whether there's a degree of torsional deformity, either external rotation or internal rotation. And clearly, whilst we're assessing dogs that are presented. We need to be aware of the potential for other joint diseases to be present, and of particular importance would be cruciate ligament disease, but also other conditions like hip dysplasia as well. There is a grading system for patellar luxation, and this is quite important to be aware of because this gives us a handle on prognosis, and it allows us at a very early stage to identify the high risk cases. So a grade 1 patellar luxation, the patella can be pushed out of the groove, but it very quickly pops straight back in and is generally quite stable. A grade 2 will pop in and out on its own, possibly with manipulation and what have you, but it will make its way in and out. This is the most common grade that we see, would be a grade 2. Grade 3 patella luxation, the patella spends all its time out of the groove, but we can put it back in by hand, and then it will generally pop straight back out again. And a grade 4, the patella is out all the time, and we cannot reduce it into the femoral trochlea. And in terms of prognosis, grade 1, 2, and 3 have a generally very good prognosis with management, but a grade 4 is a lot more guarded, and historically in the studies that have been published on patellar luxation, the grade 4 cases were always considered to have a fairly guarded prognosis. From there, we will most commonly move on to diagnostic imaging of one sort or another. Now, in practice, clearly, radiographs are going to be the way that is most commonly done. I would start with orthogonal radiographs, collimated to include as much of the surrounding bones as we can, because that gives us a better idea of limb alignment. We would normally do a medialateral projection followed by a quadricranial projection, and it's quite important if we're using radiographs to try and assess the shape of limbs that we are quite critical about the position of and the degree of rotation of the stifle joint, because even small rotations of the femur when you radiograph them will result in quite large changes in the degree of either femoral valgus or varus deformity that we may measure. And the way that we use to assess whether the distal femur is aligned properly is we look at the fibelli, which should be bisected by the medial cortex on the medial side, and over on the lateral cortex we look and see that the fibella is bisected by the lateral femoral cortex. That is a fairly crude way of assessing whether a femoral radiograph is in a straight plane. It's a limitation of plane radiographs, and it's about as good as we can get, because we can't rely on the patella occupying the central position within the femur that we would normally expect. So we can't use patella location as a reliable indicator of whether the radiograph is positioned adequately. Okay. There are some specific views that you can do in order to try to assess other factors. An axial proximodistal view, where the X-ray beam is directed from the stifle right the way down towards the hip, that has been reported to try and determine the degree of antiversion of the femur. It is very, very challenging to do, and I certainly don't bother even trying to assess this. There are far better ways available for assessing torsional deformity. So in summary, radiographs are definitely useful. However, we need to be extremely careful when we interpret the degree of deformity from radiographs, because there are huge limitations in the accuracy of the technique that we're using to measure. This picture shows the position in which I usually will obtain my quadricranial femoral radiographs. So the dog is on its back, the limb is pulled forwards, and so there's a tie that is tied onto something convenient, or even you can pull it down and tie it to something on the tabletop. But basically the idea of this position is that the femur, as you can see highlighted by these two reflective markers, the femur is lying far closer to parallel to the x-ray table than it would be if we had extended the hips out backwards as we would normally do for a hip scoring view. So that's the reason why I use this projection. What we do have to bear in mind, however, is that this means that the bone is a lot further away from the x-ray plate. I mean, we tend to use the x-ray plate in a Bucky grid. So the distance between the x-ray plate itself and the bone is quite considerable. You could be looking at maybe 10 centimeters on a largish dog, and that will lead to an appreciable degree of magnification on the radiograph. So I would always use a magnification marker that will allow me to calculate the degree of magnification when I'm using this position. Preferably, and I'm sort of very fortunate that we have on-site CT, and for me, over the last 5 years or so that we've been working with CT, CT has replaced radiography when it comes to assessing dogs with patella luxation. There are times when I will still radiograph them. That's mainly when there are cost issues, but my preferred option is to do a CT scan. CT allows us to create a variety of two-dimensional and three-dimensional images which we can use to assess femoral and tibial morphology far more accurately. And this accuracy has been quantified by two authors. So Barnes produced and quantified the accuracy of measurement based on CT, and Bill Oxley, he has also documented a way of measuring femoral varus for patella luxation. So they're both worthwhile papers. When we do a CT, the principal question in my mind is am I going to need to do a femoral osteotomy? That's the first thing I need to identify. So why do I go to CT? Well, it's basically because accurate positioning of the bone is perfectly possible in every case. Okay, we can create a three-dimensional model, such as you can see on the right-hand side, and we can rotate that 360 degrees. We can flip it. We can take bits off it. We have infinite variation. We have no problems with superimposition of other structures. Okay, so it gives us huge latitude to position the bones in the exact position we want in order to take accurate measurements. So that's the reason. The things that I look at in every case where I've CT'd for patella luxation are femoral varus and femoral torsion. The measure of femoral varus you can consider as a femoral varus angle, which is what I tend to do, or some papers reflect the measurement as an anatomic lateral distal femoral angle. We'll talk a little about that in a sec. We do assess femoral torsion, and that's measured as the angle of antiversion. The tibia can also be assessed, but once again, this would form part of a full limb realignment surgery. And, you know, I certainly assess each case to see whether the tibia looks approximately normal. But there are relatively few dogs where I will need to go and do a tibial osteotomy as a subsequent procedure to a femoral osteotomy. But we can measure the mechanical medial proximal tibial angle. What that means is if you have an abnormal angle, then the tibial plateau slopes either medially or laterally. And we can also have a torsional deformity where the hock may point in a different direction to the stifle. So that's the significance of those measurements. So when we're assessing the femur, as we've said, we assess valgus or varus, we assess torsion, and I also assess the trochlear depth. The way that we do that, we start by isolating the affected limb. So we get rid of all extra bits of bone. We cut away most of the pelvis so that we're just seeing the bit of bone that we want to see. We orientate this quite specifically by superimposing the lateral femoral condyle with the medial femoral condyle just down here. Okay, I'll just get the pointer. So by rotating backwards and forwards, we can identify a point where the two femoral condyles are exactly superimposed. That's our zero point, if you like, and that's the first thing that we do. And then because CT is quite flexible, we can tell the computer to rotate the image by exactly 90 degrees. So this is a 90 degree projection, and we start drawing lines on this. We start out by drawing the proximal anatomic axis, which is this line all the way down here. Okay, so that line is following the center point of the femoral diaphysis over two or three points, and we draw the line down. We can keep it going, you know, beyond the stifle, but I tend to stop the measurement where it crosses just in front here. We then draw the joint reference line, which is a tangent to the medial femoral condyle and the lateral femoral condyle, so that gives us an idea of the axis of the joint. And at 90 degrees to that, we draw the distal anatomic axis. Now, the points where these two lines meet, that's the proximal and the distal anatomic axis, is called the center of rotation of angulation, or the cora. And this is something that is familiar to those surgeons who do corrective osteotomy to straighten bones, because that's the point where we need to make our cut. It's typically just at the top of the femoral trochlea, and that's a fairly important point to reference off. Now, as we said earlier, we can consider the degree of femoral varus or valgus as I would suggest is the femoral varus angle. So I think, well, this dog has a 10.5 degree femoral varus angle, as you can see recorded. Or you can change it into the anatomic lateral distal femoral angle. And basically, the difference between these two is 90 degrees. So the normal anatomic lateral distal femoral angle is between 90 and 100 degrees. All you do to calculate the femoral varus angle is take 90 degrees off it, and that leaves you with the 0 to 10 degrees. So they're saying the same thing, they're just recording a slightly different value. Femoral torsion is slightly more challenging to measure. Certainly radiographically, as we've said, it's incredibly difficult. But with CT, we remove as much of the pelvis as we can while still maintaining an idea where the center of the femoral head is, as the point is indicating. The position of this 3D model on the computer screen is quite important. And what we try to orientate it is so that we imagine we're sort of staring down the barrel of the femur. So the femoral cortex, if this were made to be a transparent image, would appear as a circle in that sort of location around there. And once we have that positioned, we can draw a line through the centre of the femoral head, through the centre of the circle that the femoral cortex would define, and we continue that outright for quite a long period, and then we draw a second line, which is the caudal condylar axis, which once again is a tangent that touches the back of the femoral condyles. So the angle where those two lines meet just in there gives us the measurement of antiversion, and normally we would expect that between 20 and 30 degrees, but pretty much this is very, very difficult to assess radiographically. It's not impossible, but almost impossible. The third thing that we assess, as we mentioned, is the degree of trochlear depth, and this is where CT is really good, because we can make an accurate measurement of the depth of the femoral trochlea. Okay, so we can draw a line from the apex of one trochlear ridge to the apex of the other trochlear ridge, and we can measure down to the subchondral bone that lies in the centre of the groove. We can then compare that to the depth of the patella, and we aim for a depth of about 50% patella thickness. Okay, that's the depth of the groove that we want to have. Okay, as you can see in this case, it's way below that, so I would be looking to do a trochleoplasty in this dog. One thing that I found to my cost with one dog is that the femoral trochleas are not always symmetrical, and you can have a hyperplastic trochlear ridge, and this can be quite problematic to deal with, to be honest, but this is quite difficult to recognize in theater, because it's hard to appreciate the very subtle alteration in alignment of the trochlea. So essentially, instead of the trochlea facing vertically up the page, it's facing slightly off towards the left hand side. So, you know, this is kind of difficult, and I found out the hard way, because I had a dog that I'd corrected that kept reluxating, and it was only when we went back and very, very critically assessed the femoral trochlea that I realized that the trochlear ridge on this side was hyperplastic. So that was, I see this more often in flat-coated retrievers than probably any other breed at this point. So if we move on to treatment, how are we going to treat these dogs? Well, a grade one I would generally manage conservatively, particularly if the dog is not significantly affected. If things get worse and we start having a recurrent luxation, I would normally be thinking about surgical management for these cases. And certainly grade three and grade four, I would definitely be wanting to operate on. And the fundamental thing with surgery is that we always must try to improve primary stabilization of the patella. So that means we have to correct the quadriceps mechanism alignment. And there are only two procedures that will do that. There's either the tibial tuberosity transposition, so we can move the distal attachment of the quadriceps into a more favorable position, or we can do a femoral osteotomy. Okay, they would be the two main ways that we can realign the quadriceps mechanism. So I would always generally do one of those two procedures. And as adjunctive procedures, I will generally do one or two procedures that will improve secondary stabilization. And they would either be a trochleoplasty or soft tissue release or tightening. Now, my old boss, Malcolm McKee, whenever I approached him during my residency with X-rays of a dog with patellar luxation, he would kind of suck air between his teeth and utter the words, "a much underrated procedure." And I think this is absolutely true. These are wise words from an incredibly experienced surgeon. This surgery for patellar luxation, in whichever way you perform it, is not a recipe surgery. There are lots and lots of individual decision points. There is no one way to operate that will stabilize every single patellar luxation. Okay, so it is genuinely a much underrated procedure. So we have to assess, correct the quadriceps alignment. We have to look at the femoral trochlea and we can decide what we're going to do with it. And the options that we have are traditionally either a block recession sulcoplasty or a wedge recession sulcoplasty. There are also some other sort of more novel procedures that we'll talk about as well. And in terms of the additional secondary stabilizers, so the soft tissue aspects, the retinaculum and joint capsule, we can release and we can tighten those as we see fit at the time. So, in terms of primary stabilization, the majority of dogs can be managed by tibial tuberosity transposition. And the selection criteria that I would use for dogs that I'm going to do a tibial tuberosity transposition on are dogs with a femoral varus of less than about 10 degrees. Now, this is not necessarily a hard and fast rule, and because you have to also consider the stance of the dog. Okay, if we have a bow-legged dog with a lower femoral varus, maybe of 7 or 8 degrees, I would still consider a femoral varus. Whereas if I had a fairly straight-legged stance and I had a femoral varus angle of about 12 degrees, I would probably still do a tibial tuberosity transposition. So we have to take each case on its merits and assess the whole dog rather than just one feature. But the main things would be I don't want these dogs to be bow-legged, and I don't want to see an awful lot of femoral torsion. Okay, but if you have low varus and a fairly straight leg, then tibial tuberosity transposition is probably going to be the best way to go. So if we move on to the mechanics of a tibial tuberosity transposition, we begin by making a lateral approach to the stifle joint, and firstly perform an osteotomy of the tuberosity. Now, I started off doing these osteotomies with hand instruments. So this, you can see, this was when I was doing my residency and we were using a finger saw. This is fairly straightforward. You can do it with a hacksaw blade, although it will sort of tend to cut into your hand a bit. But basically, we slip the saw blade underneath the patella tendon and make a cut from proximal to distal. Okay, we've got to take care that we don't completely cut through the bone at the distal end. We don't want to cut through the periosteum just down here, but we leave that as a sort of a hinge point, if you like. But we cut down as far as we can until we can start to transpose the tuberosity laterally or medially. So often when you start to transpose, there will be a little click as any remaining cortical bone will snap, but the periosteum will remain intact, and that's absolutely fine. Okay, so we transpose the bone and then we stabilize with K wires, so little tiny pins, generally less than 2 millimeters diameter, Very tiny dogs, I might use 0.9 millimeter K wires. Very large dogs, I'll use 2 millimeter K wires. But we basically position the tuberosity in the position where we judge the quadriceps alignment is correct, and then we place a pin. At that point, we check the tracking of the patella and manipulate the joint in internal rotation and external rotation, and we want the patella to remain in the trochlea if we can. Okay. In larger dogs, I will generally place a tension band wire. I suppose anything above 10 kilos, you know, I will place a tension band wire. With smaller dogs, I used to always place a tension band wire, but they can sometimes lead to complications that we were best avoiding. So in little tiny toy and toy breed dogs, I often don't place a tension band wire. But as you can see, the tension band wire is a figure of eight. We drill a hole distal to the tuberosity. We need to make sure it goes through the medullary canal, and rather than just skipping along the surface of the cortical bone, so it needs to be far enough back into the femur. Pass a wire through, and I tend to do a double twist, so we have one twist on this side and one twist on the other side, and that just means that you can tighten the cyclage wire quite easily. I generally anchor the cyclage wire over the more proximal of the two K wires. I always place two K wires in here, so the wire goes over the top of that one, and then subsequently we bend these over and fold them back and cut the wire short so that they're lying alongside the straight patella ligament. Okay, these can cause problems with rubbing in some dogs. We'll just move back. Clearly, we do post-operative radiographs once we've completed a tibial tuberosity transposition, and that's really to assess adequacy of implant position and also where your osteotomy lies. Now, the commonest problems that we see with the commonest intraoperative problems that we see with tibial tuberosity transposition is not taking a deep enough piece of bone. Okay, it's a real mistake to take a little fine thin sliver. You need to be fairly brave and get quite far back, you know, sometimes almost to the cruciate ligament, and you're better off having a bigger piece of bone than a little tiny wafer thin strip of bone that will just come to bits. So bear that in mind. Make sure you take enough bone here. That is actually easier to take a nice deep chunk of bone if you use a sagittal saw in order to make the cut. So I tend to use a pneumatic sagittal saw now rather than a finger saw or hand saw. Power tools are lovely to have, so I do like those. Right, so that sort of brings to a close the tibial tuberosity aspect. We'll move now on to talking about the femoral osteotomies that we may consider in dogs with a significant degree of varus or indeed valgus if we're looking at a lateral luxation. So the dogs I would consider femoral osteotomy in as a ballpark guide would have femoral varus angle of 10 degrees or greater, and they may well have torsion as well. And one of the important benefits of femoral osteotomy as a treatment to realign the quadriceps mechanism is that it allows improved alignment of the trochlea, which you can see here is lying at an angle to the shaft of the bone. So that is dramatically improved with femoral osteotomy. Okay. I will often do femoral osteotomy if we have to revise a failed tibial tuberosity transposition. That's often because the anatomy of the limb has not been adequately appreciated, and possibly a suboptimal surgery was chosen in the first place. So sometimes we will do them as a secondary procedure. Femoral osteotomy, I think it goes without saying, is a demanding surgery, and I think that if you're considering undertaking a corrective osteotomy of the femur, you should have a real think of the abilities that you have. This is not something to do on a wing and a prayer. You need to be very adept at manipulating bones, creating osteotomies accurately, and reducing what is essentially then a fracture, and applying implants, permanent implants. So you have to be very competent at all of those things before I would suggest anyone attempts a femoral osteotomy. There are lots of problems that you could face if these factors are not properly addressed. For the typical medial patellar luxation, we will look to make an osteotomy. It's a wedge-shaped osteotomy at the centre of rotation of angulation that we mentioned earlier, and we're going to base the wedge. The wedge is going to be widest at the lateral aspect, and it will taper to meet at the medial cortex, so that when we bring the two resulting bone surfaces together, we straighten the femur. This has got to be produced accurately. You can't adequately do this with hand instruments. Okay, you need to have a sagittal saw, as you can see on the picture over here. This is a sagittal saw as part of a maxi driver, which is a fairly robust pneumatic tool set. So that's important that you have appropriate instrumentation. We also will frequently use a parallel jig, and this is what these pins are. One pin is located just at the top of the femoral trochlea. The second pin is located exactly parallel to the first pin, part way up the femur. These are just thin, generally Ellis pins. And the jig that is attached, that you can see around here, this is the jig. It has hinged arms that will allow these two pins to move closer together or further apart, but it won't allow this bone fragment distally to rotate in relation to this bone fragment proximally. So it just helps to keep your alignment. Now, obviously, if you have a torsional correction, it may not be helpful to apply a parallel jig. But in cases where there's no torsional correction, it's quite a nice way to keep everything in alignment, and it certainly makes reduction a bit more straightforward. When we come to remove the wedge of bone and we go to reduce the two bone segments together, we may maintain those in position using either temporary K wires or reduction forceps or a combination of the two. But we would need to apply some sort of temporary fixation whilst we contour and apply the bone plate. This is the sort of bone plate that we generally use, or I generally use. This is a bone plate. It started out life as a supracondylar fracture plate that would originally have extended right the way up to the top of the femur, but as a consequence of developing implants for this specific position, we specified that the plate could be shorter, and we missed out some screw holes where the osteotomy was going to lie. So to my mind, this is a really nice implant to use for this situation. It does need some contouring. In the larger sizes of plate, it is a very robust implant indeed, and so bending the plate can be quite challenging, and that needs to be done in theatre because we're changing the shape of the femur, so we can't even pre-bend the plate desperately well. So you've got to be prepared to do that in theatre. And the aim of the plate is really to maintain accurate alignment of the bone fragments and wherever possible achieve interfragmentary compression by the use of the cortical screws in the oval dynamic compression plate holes on the shaft. Okay, so hopefully you're familiar with bone plating, so that will make sense. Once we have plated the osteotomy and we've closed the joint capsule and the soft tissues and the skin, we then move to radiography for assessment. And this might sound a little incongruent that we've used CT for assessing the pre-op femoral varus angle, but we use radiography for the post-op. And that's absolutely right. But the reason for doing that is that when you take a CT, we have x-rays flying all over the place from the CT scanner, and when you put a metal implant next to an area that you need to see, you often get so much artifact produced that it can mean that the images are almost worthless, particularly when the bone plate extends within a few millimeters of the femoral condyles. That's quite likely to happen. So we do assess these cases radiographically using plain radiography, and we're just very careful with how we position the limb and use the cordocranial method as we described earlier. So we're assessing the degree of femoral varus, and I normally aim somewhere between 0 degrees and 5 degrees. We assess implant position, and it's important that we don't place screws into the joint, particularly we don't want them crossing the femoral trochlea where they will interfere with the patella tracking, and we also have to assess the degree of reduction of the osteotomy. Now the osteotomy here was made across here, so that's nicely compressed, so quite happy with those post-operative radiographs. We're going to jump back a little bit now, because I've tried to compartmentalize the surgical procedures that realign the primary stabilization mechanisms of the patella and consider those together. So that's why the tibial tuberosity transposition and the femoral osteotomy have been separated off. But in effect, during surgery, before we close up, we may well need to address the secondary stabilizers. So they're in a slightly separate area of the talk, but they are performed at the same time or even before we do surgery when it comes to trochleoplasty. So the secondary stabilizers are the trochlea and the soft tissues, particularly the joint capsule and the retinaculum. For those of you who are wondering what the retinaculum is, it's this structure here that I'm sure you're all familiar with models of this sort. It's this band that attaches to the lateral aspect of the patella. In real life, it isn't a discrete band. It's a thickening within the joint capsule, so you won't see it as an individual structure like this. But when you do your osteotomy and put your pair of scissors through the joint capsule and cut up through here, you'll find a really crunchy, gristly bit, and that's the retinaculum that you're going through. So that's what we're wanting to tighten. You can see it if you reflect the joint capsule. You can identify where the retinaculum is, and it's important if you're stitching it that you pick up sutures through that retinaculum. So let's move on to the mechanics of trochleoplasty, because this is an important subject. Now, frequently I come across people who are planning to operate on a dog with patellar luxation, and they say, I'm just going to go and do a trochleoplasty. Now, that is not really going to stand a very good chance of sorting the problem out. And this is regardless of the method of trochleoplasty. Please bear in mind that this is a secondary stabilizer. It isn't the primary problem, so treat the underlying cause. Now, there are three main types of trochleoplasty that are employed. The abrasion trochleoplasty, I hope, has been consigned to the history books. There is no place in the vast majority of cases. There is absolutely no need to take a rasp to the trochlea and just rasp it out so that it's deeper. It's a hideous surgery to do. You're condemning the dog to a painful knee for the rest of its life, and there's no need for that to be the case. So abrasion trochleoplasty I will mention, but I don't have any pictures of it because I've never done one and hopefully never will, but it is reported. The wedge recession sulcoplasty has been around for a lot of years, and it's generally quite a successful way to deepen the groove. And what we basically do is we make two cuts that are converging towards the caudal aspect of the femur. We start our cuts just inside the trochlear ridges on either side, and once we've made the cut and this little sort of wedge has popped out, make sure you don't drop the wedge, that's not a good thing to do. Then we have to try and deepen the groove, and we generally do that by making a second cut on one side. It doesn't matter which side you go, but you make another very, very thin parallel cut that goes deep down, and that gives you a slightly deeper wedge that hopefully, so long as your second cut is parallel to your first, hopefully the wedge that's in your hand will pop straight back in and be a sort of high friction fit. That's how it's meant to work. If you are careless with how you make the wedge, or if you make the wedge too shallow, then you may end up with a very unstable wedge. And this is what I never particularly like with the wedge recession sulcoplasty. The other thing that is a tangible problem with wedge recession is you can only really deepen the groove in the middle of the trochlea. Okay, it's very hard to deepen the trochlea proximally or distally. Okay, my preferred option, and I've been doing these since 2005 now, so you know, quite a while, is to do a block recession sulcoplasty. This is a little bit technically slightly harder than a wedge, I suspect, but once you've mastered the technique, it's a lot more flexible, and certainly it gives us far greater control over where and how deep we can improve trochlear depth. So a block recession sulcoplasty, we start by making two parallel cuts down the inside of the trochlear ridge on both sides. So they're made with a hard back saw. Veterinary instrumentation sell several versions. One's called the X-Acto saw, which is like a little balsa wood saw, and the other one is a stainless steel one that is specifically designed for this task. So we make two parallel cuts, and then we take an osteotome of an appropriate width. This is technically a chisel, but an osteotome, and we chisel out the block that needs to be fairly deep, to be honest, and we save that block of cartilage. Now, often it's necessary to osteotome from the distal end, moving proximally, and then when you think you've gone far enough, I'll take the osteotome up to where the green arrow is just now, and osteotome from proximal down to distal. And resultant channel that you end up with once you've taken the block out is fairly hideous. It's quite deep, and it should it's quite a big hole. But then what we do is we deepen the groove by removing additional bone from the channel. Okay. Once that channel has been deepened, and we can deepen it either more proximally, more distally, more in the middle, we then replace the block and the cartilage that's lined with the hyaline cartilage, and press it down into the block, and it generally is quite stable. So that's a block recession sulcoplasty. There are some alternatives that have come around fairly recently, namely the Orthomed ridge stop, which is a very expensive piece of plastic that you screw onto generally the medial trochlear ridge. And there's also the Keon patella groove replacement that is a fairly elegant way of providing an alternate trochlear. I think it's important to remember that both of these techniques are very poorly evaluated. I'm not aware of any published literature that reports the success, failure, complication rate, and other issues relating to these techniques. But they are available. I have no experience of doing either of those. And to be honest, I think that for the majority of cases, I'm not convinced they offer a huge amount. I think in some situations where you have very established patellofemoral osteoarthritis, or if someone has previously done an abrasion sulcoplasty, and the cartilage within the trochlear is permanently damaged, then I would consider a patella groove replacement. But for the run-of-the-mill patella luxations, I think it's a very, very large sledgehammer to crack a very, very small nut. So I wouldn't jump straight to that. So now we've covered the trochleoplasty. We need to think a little about the soft tissues, and the purpose of the soft tissue procedures we may consider are to balance soft tissue tension between medial and lateral side. Now, the degree of tension that we need to achieve varies from dog to dog. All I can say is we need to balance it. So if you find you have a medial patellar luxation and the medial side of the joint is very tight, we may need to release that by doing a desmotomy. But in the majority of cases, I probably won't. I will just tighten the lateral side to balance the soft tissues with a normal joint capsule. More severe cases are more likely to require both release and tightening during the same surgery. So both of these can occur. And the analogy I always use with clients when I'm talking about soft tissue release and tightening is it's like establishing tension in the guy ropes of your tent. If you have a slack guy rope on one side, then the tent will fall over, and that's corrected by tightening or loosening one side or the other. So tightening is fairly straightforward. We can either overlap the joint capsule and retinaculum, or we can cut away what spare retinaculum and joint capsule there is. I tend to cut away, I excise it, and then suture them closed. A lot of people will just overlap the capsule. Okay. Release of the generally the medial joint capsule and retinaculum, that's often necessary in grade 4 cases, probably all grade 4 cases, because by definition they have a patella that is not used to going back into the trochlear. Generally they will need a desmotomy, and there are varying degrees of how aggressive you need to be. Sometimes it's adequate just to cut the retinaculum, but sometimes you have to be quite aggressive and cut the retinaculum and joint capsule from the tibial plateau right the way up to the most proximal extent of the joint capsule. So, you know, that's quite an aggressive thing to do, but it is necessary in some cases. And I generally, if I do any sort of release or tightening, I leave that unsutured. So that may mean that the joint capsule has a big hole in it, because there's no point releasing something if you're going to stitch it back together and tighten it up again, because you've just kind of ruined the effect that you were wanting. But you do sometimes have to leave the joint capsule unsutured, and that can sometimes be quite a daunting prospect if you've never done it before. Once we have all of these three parts addressed, so by that we're talking about realignment of the quadriceps mechanism, the trochlea is deep or deep enough, and we've balanced soft tissue tension, then we check stability. Okay, and this is the last chance to go back and alter something that you've done. We verify patella stability and tracking with flexion and extension, both with internal and external rotation of the paw. Okay, and this will apply a variety of forces to the patella to try and encourage it to leave the groove, and then we follow that up with radiography. Management after surgery composes analgesia. I tend to have the dogs on something like Pardale V as paracetamol and codeine combined with an anti-inflammatory. I will generally have them on some antibiotics if I've put permanent implants in place. That would be supplemented with exercise restriction. So for 4 weeks, I will have them on short lead only walks. I'll get the owners doing physiotherapy and passive range of motion exercises. And most importantly, we avoid self-trauma. So an Elizabethan collar is a very useful thing to do for 7 to 10 days. Complications that can happen. Reluxation would be the commonest complication. And that generally is something that occurs if you haven't got the quadriceps muscle properly aligned. So we may need to go back and consider if we've done a tibial tuberosity transposition, would it be beneficial to do a femoral osteotomy? Or if we've transposed the tuberosity, has there been some sort of movement? So the tuberosity has moved back, or has the cruciate ligament ruptured and therefore the tibia is now in a different place, the tuberosity is now in a different place, or has the transposition been inadequate in the first place. So we have to consider these things. We also may find that the patella will reluxate if there's been failure of the secondary stabilizers. So if we didn't do a trochleoplasty, would we have been better off doing so? Do we need to go and do a trochleoplasty? And also the soft tissue balance, was the tension adequately balanced? So they're the things to consider. We do see infection, although with diligent operative technique, then we should be able to keep the risk of infection to a minimum. We see implant-related problems, and the most common problem that we see is that the K-wires, where they emerge from the tibia, will just rub on the patella tendon, and sometimes we get implant-related pain in that area. It can cause a patella tendonitis. Normally, the treatment for that is to remove the implants, and that's obviously once the bone has healed, and then generally the pain will subside. And very rarely, and I've over the years I've seen two cases where dogs have sustained tibial fractures. Generally happens at the base of the tibial tuberosity, about where you put the hole for your tension band wire. And all the dogs that I've seen this in have been toy breed dogs. So be very careful with your tension band wire hole, particularly in toy breed dogs. And certainly in very small dogs, I often won't use a tension band wire at all. I will just place the two K wires as fixation. So fracture is quite a distressing and quite a serious complication, but so long as it can be adequately managed, and this one was managed with a bone plate, then the prognosis is still generally very, very good. So, as we said, good prognosis in general, providing we can achieve proper quadriceps alignment. We need to use adequate implants, and that is especially important if you're doing things like femoral osteotomies. And the recovery period, it's always worth warning the owners that if we do a sulcoplasty or if we do a femoral osteotomy, then the recovery period is more likely to be prolonged. But in general, I would expect most dogs will regain an active life in the future. Okay, so that kind of brings us to the end of talking about the various developments in patella luxation. Hopefully, it's given you some food for thought. And if you have any questions, then I would be happy to address them just now. Thank you. Okay, so we have a question in from one of the delegates, and that question relates to the presence of bilateral disease. So, with dogs that are affected with bilateral patella luxation, would I operate on both knees at the same time, or would I operate on one leg first and then the other? And I think this decision is always a difficult one, and we have to bear in mind several factors. So we have to consider the owner and their ability to fulfill diligent post-operative care. We have to consider the temperament of the animal, because if you have a really very exuberant dog, it may struggle to it may damage the implants if it does too much too soon. So I would use factors like that. However, if I have good owner compliance, and if I have a dog of a temperament that I think is going to be suitable, I will operate on both knees simultaneously at the same surgery. However, I am fairly confident that my repair will be robust. I am in a position where I can be absolutely 100% certain that the piece of bone that I transpose from the tibial tuberosity will be thick enough, because I'm cutting it with a sagittal saw, and there's less tendency for that instrument to wander and give me a little thin, feeble tibial crest transposition. So I will do bilateral disease at the right time with the right cases. However, if you are starting on your orthopedic career and you've done a few of these, but not hundreds, then I would suggest you do one first and then the other. So hopefully that answers your question.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Simon for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.